Kion, have you seen that book I was reading earlier?
Alarm clock, movie camera, laughing with tears, cat face.
I don't understand.
Angry purple face with horns. People bowing deeply with medium light skin tone.
Are you speaking only in emojis?
Dog, pig nose, a monkey that can speak no evil, face with cold sweat.
How long is this going to go on?
Frog, screaming in fear cat face, footprints, smiling pile of poo.
This really is devolution. We've evolved sophisticated language systems, and what are we replacing them with? Idiotic pictographs. You should be embarrassed to be part of this.
Flushed face. Unhappy sideways cat face. Face of chicken who cannot find the correct emoji.
Oh, just introduce the show.
Nose with medium light skin tone. Smiling pile of poo. And now, police chasing wild boar with medical mask.
That's me, I guess. That's how you say Colin McEnroe in emoji. Not really exactly, but we will be talking about... In fact, like, we almost can't wait to get to it because judging from the pre-show conversation, that's like what everybody seemed to want to talk about. But we have many other things to talk about before we get to emojis. As you may or may not know, Oxford Dictionaries have named an emoji the word of the year, a specific emoji. But it's sort of, I think, a placeholder for all emojis. Anyway, we'll come to that. That's not where we're going to begin today. We're going to begin today, first of all, by telling you who's here. Writer Gourmand and many other things, Rand Richards Cooper, is here from Trinity College. Irene Papoulis, professor of many things, is here. And then truly a person of many aspects, even just in this week alone. Let's just say that when they finally do build that celebrity only air terminal at Los Angeles, I think she'll be one of the first people to use it. Comedian, dancer, choreographer, writer, actor, person who's in commercials, Carolyn Payne, and I'm sure I'm leaving some things out too, is with us. So that's who's with us. We're going to begin by talking about the announcement of Charlie Sheen earlier this week on the Today Show that he's HIV positive. I mean, there's some ways in which we'd like to kind of pull that one apart a little bit, just and then go from there. Well, Rand liked the way that Charlie Sheen or somebody writing for Charlie Sheen used words. And I'd been thinking a lot lately that this is one of the last defensible prejudices, you know, that we really do like the way people speak if they speak the way that we like to speak. And we don't like people who don't use words the way that we do. So anyway, we're going to talk about that and also about the kind of the deformalization, the informalization of formally formal speech. It's kind of called NPR speak. Everybody kind of talks like Ira Glass now. Anyway, we'll explain more to you about that. So we've got a pretty full plate, as you can tell. We've got to dive right in. So the announcement came this week on the Today Show, where all important things are announced. Charlie Sheen said that he had had he is HIV positive for a number of years now, that he's paid upward of $10 million to keep quiet, to keep other people quiet, we should say, about his condition, and that he wanted to. Well, he's basically was saying he's been extorted by people he knows, and he's tired of that. And the way to make that stop is to come clean, as it were. So that's what he did. And so, Irene, I know you watched the clip of him talking to Matt Lauer in all of its fullness. Did you see things there that were intriguing to you, specifically intriguing to you?
Yeah, I did, but probably a lot of people will disagree with me. But
well, that's good.
Yeah. I mean, I just see the shame pouring out of him when he was talking. I felt like, you know, it made me think about his life as the son of Martin Sheen, and you know, the privilege, incredible privilege that he was born into, and then he kind of just, you know, the way he the person that he turned out to be was, I'm sure, very, you know, problematic to his family for many reasons and everything. And so he got this diagnosis, and I was thinking, wow, why did he spend all that money, millions of dollars, to you know, because he was ashamed, you know. I mean, my friend then said to me, no, he just didn't want anyone to know so that he could keep having sex, you know. But for me, just the mannerisms, you know, so that's where I start. And also just there's something that seems real to me about the way he is, even if people might disagree with me.
All right. I confess I didn't see it quite that way, but I want to go around the table here. Carolyn, why don't you go next? What did you see there?
Well, I didn't see him as being real. And I know Rand called into question his use of language. I don't, you know, I kind of have been neutral on Charlie Sheen. I mean, he's sort of just continually become this character that is sort of unraveling before us in the past decade, I think. Because I can remember, like, when I was younger and he was – I remember he was – I thought he was, like, really hot, you know? And then now, like, if you – I mean, regardless of the – I mean, I just – if you asked me, like, 5 years ago, like, is Charlie Sheen hot? I would have been like, oh, God, no. Like, I don't want to go near him.
You wouldn't have
ever
wanted to be one of his goddesses.
No, I am even, all set
so
without
that was
becoming –
even before his meltdown?
Yeah. Even, like, during Two and a Half Men, you know, there just seemed to be this just this, like, descent into madness. And then during this interview, I love that Rand gave us, you know, broke down exactly what he said here. But his use of words – and this kind of plays into what we're talking about – I don't believe – I have trouble believing that Charlie Sheen uses that level of vocabulary.
All right. Just to give people a sense of what that level of vocabulary is, here's a little bit from the Matt Lauer interview.
You wrote this to me in a letter and shared it with me yesterday. In and around this perplexing and difficult time, I dazedly chose or hired the companionship of unsavory and insipid types. I'm imagining prostitutes. Regardless of their saltless reputations – I always led with condoms and honesty when it came to my condition. Sadly, my truth soon became their treason as a deluge of blackmail and extortion took center stage in this circus of deceit. Were these people that you had had sexual contact with and were claiming that you had transmitted the virus to them? Or were these people who simply found out about your status and were threatening to tell the world?
More the latter. For some reason I trusted them. They were deep in my inner circle, and I thought that they could be helpful. And instead, they as I wrote, my trust turned to their treason. You
so
know?
Are we talking about lawsuits filed against you here, Charlie? Are we talking about shakedowns?
We're talking about shakedowns. Yeah.
We certainly now have Charlie Sheen's epitaph. He always led with condoms and honesty. So yes, Rand, what did you hear in those words?
Well, I'm just going to bracket for a moment the question of the particular language because it leads us right into the next topic we're discussing. But I do want to say it was surprising to me to learn that he had paid out millions of dollars, that's necessary. I think that's sort of what Irene was saying at the beginning. And it recalled me – I think it's hard for anyone who's under, say, 35 or so to remember what it was like in the 80s and early 90s when – I'm not talking about you specifically. There are a lot of people listening out there who at a time when to be HIV positive was to believe that you had received then and there a death sentence – when fear rolled through the culture really like a tsunami and totally blasted in particular sectors of the society. And people were terrified. The management and you saw in the outing of various people who had AIDS, which was often a simultaneous outing if they were public figures like actors, that they were gay. And the overnight transformation of Magic Johnson into a pariah, basketball players would not step on the court with him. And there's like a sort of last reverberating dreadful echo of that in what obviously Charlie Sheen has gone through. And it, so for me, it rocketed me back 25 years to a time and also a time, honestly, very personally, because I fell into a high-risk category when I was terrified that I was HIV positive and I got tested numerous times. So this was like a last recrudescence of a kind of cultural dread that for the most part we've put behind us, and that's sort of the first response I had to this.
I think that there's still my best friend from childhood, and I've spoken about him on this because I've helped him with various projects that he's done as an artist that have stemmed from this. But my best friend from childhood is HIV positive, and he kept it a secret for about 6 years. Including from, I mean, I knew within that, but there was a period where even his closest friends and family, he didn't want to tell. And I think it's an interesting, it does. And I think because we grew up in a time where we were aware of that. And, you know, I can remember the Magic Johnsons and all of this. So I do think that there is still so much shame that people feel in coming forward with this, and just the fear, and I think just feeling like they're going to be persecuted
for
that.
We got a little tickle of that this week when actress, if that's the right word, Jenny McCarthy, always to be counted upon for interesting perspectives on public health, complained that she was in a role on Two and a Half Men where she would kiss Charlie Sheen with some regularity, and that she was not told about this, and this was unfair. That apparently, I didn't know this. Maybe this is something you've had to do, Carolyn. I don't know. That you actually do, if you're going to kiss somebody on television, you have to say whether you have a cold sore. You have to sign
well,
a form.
Well, it depends on different situations, but generally it is something that you do want to disclose just out of respect for the other actor.
Right.
They generally.
She said there's a form. If you have a lip herpes, you have to.
I had to fill out a form like that for a show I was on where I had a sex scene, and you had to fill out a form regarding some personal health issues that you could be sharing for the day.
To me, one of the interesting questions is who's ashamed of what? So I see Charlie Sheen as a guy who, in the past, seemed in the kind of self-destructive cycle that Carolyn has described. First of all, flaunting it before our eyes in recent years, right? I mean, having these interviews where you were just sort of watching him circle this personally constructed toilet of misery and debauchery. And I saw that as – I think we all project how we want to, or we project – so to me, that's – his father really is this rather – as actors go, upright and dignified and purposeful man. And I thought that very well might be a taunt, look what I turned into, Dad. Look how much I've disappointed you. It occurred to me, I'm not saying that's the case, but it occurred to me that that was possible. But it's interesting what people are and are not ashamed of. So, yes, he didn't want anyone to know that he was HIV positive. No, a lot of that is because there's a fairly limited number of ways you can become HIV positive. He says in the interview he would not have been through a needle, through intravenous drug use, injectable drugs. He doesn't do that. But he also refused to say how he thought he got it, which is his business, obviously. There's no particular reason why he should have to. Although if you're making the argument, well, I'm doing this for the sake of public education, well, then you probably should say how you think you got it. I agree that there was shame there, but it was sort of unclear to me what the shame was. In some ways, in this society, which prizes health and vivacity and vigor so much, sometimes people are just ashamed if they get sick from anything.
Right. Yeah, I think so. And but I think the image that he was projecting even during his meltdown was, invincible,
Right. And didn't he even say he was invincible at one point?
Because he drank
tiger blood.
Yeah, well, and that's why I just love that. Like, Matt Lauer is just so funny. I mean, just on some level, he just, the way he sort of acts like, okay, whatever it is, I'm just going to act like we're having a regular interview, And he said something at one point, how long ago was it that you found out? And he said 4 years. And he said, okay, was that the time of the tiger blood and all that, or something like that? And Charlie, instead of saying yes, which I expected Charlie Sheen to say, I'm going to just blame
that
it all
on
that.
That would have helped that, yeah.
He said no. And that to me seemed like he was trying – he has this urge to be honest. I mean, it's not consistent and it's all messed up and confused and everything, but there's some desire in there somewhere, I think, at least that's how I read it, to actually be honest. Like, his face just looks so – he's so intense. When you look at his face, he's not he's trying so hard.
Well, I mean, having gone through this in a personal way, I mean, my heart goes out to him, and I know that this is a hard thing. But I think he's a really good actor, mm-hmm. And I think a lot of what came across to me on the Today Show was Charlie Sheen doing a really good performance of coming out with this and talking, and I think the bottom line was he didn't want to be extorted anymore. So it was a kind of selfish way of coming out
What's interesting about that is that in former eras, the prospect of a celebrity unraveling publicly would have been clearly seen and understood for what it was. That is a disaster. Now, Charlie Sheen, to whom I haven't been paying direct attention, but he's sort of like a loud noise in another room. You know it's going on. And it seems that he's been unraveling for years. Yeah. Now, we live in an era where now the sort of the backstage realities of things, the inner architecture of things is always brought to the surface. And we have confounded and conflated the foreground and the background and mixed them in weird ways to entertain ourselves. So it's no longer clear, and thus to your point, Carolyn, whether in this kind of situation, whether we're really seeing someone melting down or someone producing a great facsimile of something that sells well as entertainment. And that becomes at some level a kind of hall of mirrors, you know, interpretively.
I think so too. And I think there's also a sense that he's kind of a fusion. He's kind of a chimera of two different things. And one of them is the thing that you're talking about right now, Rand, that these days you're unraveling. In the world of reality television and stuff, unraveling is something that people watch. And it's marketed to them, and there are these stars like Bethany Frankel, whose only real attribute
that's what they do.
Yeah, she has no boundaries. She has no boundaries whatsoever. She will allow a television camera to film her pooping, or you know, or having a you know.
Wow, I never heard of Bethany Frankel.
Bethany Frankel, yeah, she's
Real
like
Housewives
sort
of New York.
Yes, yeah.
Uh-huh.
There's that favorite emoji.
Yeah, there you go. Or having her OBGYN exam. She doesn't care. She'll just do it. So you sort of got that, and Charlie Sheen has been part of that. He's put on this incredible spectacle of himself over time. But you also have, you know, this all used to be taken care of by handlers, right? Movie stars had these incredible apparatus of, you know, publicists and stuff like that. Like I found out today, I was trying to think of a good example of this. So I found out today that Raymond Burr was gay. I had no idea Raymond Burr was gay. And we were just doing a thing about the Rear Window, which, of course, he's the villain on. But, I mean, I was a big Perry Mason fan. I liked him on Ironsides. I had no idea he was gay because I was not meant to know that. And, in fact, what his publicist and he did was invent wives who never existed and died. He had two dead wives who were completely fictional. But, like, if you were reading about Raymond Burr back in the day, you read about these two wives he had who died. But there weren't one of them was like a Scottish actress or something. I mean, they like had these backstories. They were completely fictional. You can't do that now because Radar Online or something is flyspecking you and everything that you say. But in a way, this seemed like it was a little bit of a throwback to those days. Like he had for 4 years and at a cost of $10 million tried to manage a story in the old way. And I was also struck by the casualness of extortion. You know, it's kind of like, well, people who know you, you know. They're going to ask for money after they take pictures of your medicine in the medicine cabinet. Yeah.
I live in fear of everyone I know right now.
It's a world where there's such confusion about what is real, what is the real person, what is the authentic person. You know, there's like these little bits that sort of seem realer than the person, than the polished image.
And what is public but and what is private.
Yeah, and what is public and what is private. I just wish my father were alive so he could hear that news about Raymond Burr. That would be so – he would have been so interested.
Yeah. But I mean, there is confusion about – I mean, I think in Charlie Sheen you see confusion about what should be public and what should be private. He's been public in the past about things that I would never tell anybody. I would never want anyone to know those things if they were true about me.
Right.
And then he's also been private about something that, you know, although it's, you know, it is something that freaks people out, it's also something that the sooner you come clean about it, the truth does set you free on that one. So
that's why he doesn't seem calculating. I mean, it seems like he's just as confused as we are about where the real him is.
All right. We're going to segue from that. So you heard the clip that we played in which he's using all kinds of words. I'm not sure I would call a prostitute insipid, but he does. Even introduces his state of mind with the adjective dazedly. And so, Rand, you said as we were passing emails back and forth that it made you like him better. I don't know how seriously you meant that, but you probably did.
Oh, I meant it.
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, I mistook those when I saw in the article. I thought these were quotations. I thought he had spoken those words.
Yeah.
The fact that he had written that in a letter opens up another dimension. Who actually wrote that?
Yeah.
Nonetheless, there are certain eccentric uses of words there that suggest to me that he actually
did write it. I think he did write it for that
because
reason.
Because if a professional had written that, they probably would not use dazedly.
Yeah.
It's an unusual adverb.
But didn't you get the sense that he sat there with like a thesaurus? Like, well, I'd like him to use, you know, deluge
but,
in a
but,
regular
well,
sentence.
Well, maybe, but, you know, I mean, we can sort of deconstruct whatever might have
gone
into it.
I don't think he knows what insipid means.
But to produce that I dazedly chose or hired the companionship of unsavory and insipid types. So to me, and I know we're going to go on to talk about sort of types of speakers, these were like slight – there was a slight loopiness to the uses of these words. Now, maybe he's just showing off and maybe it's like, oh, here are my $10 words. But to me, I found a sort of attractive, just sort of slightly wobbly, slippery use of these words that seemed like almost accidentally poetic. And I liked him more. He seemed stranger in a good way to me for having used words that way. I liked it.
I do believe if you listen to the way that he talks, it's exactly that. He's reaching for words that he doesn't have quite control over, that he doesn't quite know them, but he also does sort of know them. And so the letter was written kind of the way that he talks. And I actually think it was written by him and not by his handlers, because it does sort of ring true that way. And but it also brings up this idea that I've been thinking a lot about this recently, that one of the ways that we identify with or oppose people is how they talk. So when Donald Trump stands up there and like his idea of a really profound statement is, that's a top thing. and I'm going, well, those are all one-syllable words. You're not really saying anything. And, you know, but that would be something like, this is a top thing. And I'm sitting there thinking, what an idiot. But in fact, if you are a very plain-spoken person who doesn't particularly like the use of either idiosyncratic or flowery word choices, you like Donald Trump because it seems to – first of all, it seems to you that he's not trying to conceal anything, but also he talks like you do.
Well, that's like Sarah Palin. A lot of her appeal was that folksy appeal, that when she spoke, everyone could understand what she was saying, as opposed to politicians who tend to pontificate and use all these big words that are more intimidating. Like, I mean, I've admitted openly several times I'm intimidated when Rand starts going. And there have been times, one time on air, he used a word I didn't even know. I had to look it up while we're on air. I was looking up the word so that I could respond and not sound like an idiot.
What was it?
I don't even remember now. I didn't learn the experience.
but even like with Donald Trump, I think he's one of the most horrible people ever. But when he says huge, it's going to be huge. I can relate to that since I'm from New York, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something familiar. It's because of the familiarity, too. So I'm agreeing. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm fascinated by this. And I do feel as though I knew exactly what Rand meant when he said, I like him better for using those kinds of words. And there are people whose ideas I've either found provocative or despicable or who've I've enjoyed none. I mean, Christopher Hitchens is a great example, all right? Christopher Hitchens and I, we probably would agree about 50% of the time, or maybe less than 50% of the time. But his use of words was so wonderful. Even to hear him not just write but to speak. I just watched this William F. Buckley, Gore Vidal documentary where Hitchens is still alive and is commenting on it, and just the way this man talks, I just like that. You know, I am going to give him the benefit of certain doubts. You know, I'm going to look past his positions on some things just because I like the way he uses words, and it's the way I wish I used words that well, but it's the way I want to use words.
Well, you know, a lot of the sort of implicit subject of this conversation is what's the relationship between articulateness and intelligence, and it can be confounding to hear someone who's inarticulate and try, like Donald Trump, and understand, know that there is some sort of acumen behind that, but that it's not the kind that finds its way into articulate speech. Now, we tend to
– are we laughing because he just used like 500 big words in that sentence?
Well, no. No, because
– acumen?
Because of the construction that it doesn't
right.
find its way into articulate speech. That's perfect.
Right. Yeah. So you have to – one challenge for people who perhaps overvalue eloquence is that they become deaf to forms of intelligence that are not expressed that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I remember, I can recall very well specific instances when I was with someone who spoke in a certain idiom that was not impressive to me. But I realized this person's really smart. And I remember being in my 20s, I was out in California visiting a friend in Southern California. And his girlfriend had another friend who spoke in this sort of like valley girl bimbo sort of way. And I was having a lot of trouble really even understanding what the person in there was trying to say. And then we were in some situation, I forget, she was describing a party she'd been at and her quick take on one of the guests, and she in staccato fashion just said, well, he was this and that and you know, gun in his waistband, maybe, I'm out of there. And I realized, oh, this person goes right. She understands people. She sums them up. She gets a very quick take on people. Okay, she's like playing this instrument that is really bizarre and alien to me. I don't like the melody, but there's really a musician in there composing thoughts, but in a way that's strange to me. And you know, I've tried. I mean, I tend to value people who speak elaborately and who are agile. Colin, on his feet, being extemporaneously metaphorical, referred to Charlie Sheen's watching Charlie Sheen circle a personally constructed toilet of debauchery and misery. Now, I love it when people talk like that because they're on their feet coming up with an apt metaphor and then just spinning it off. There's a performance aspect to people who are, you know, sort of mesmerizing talkers.
And you're one of those people. And so that's why you like that. You know, because I think it's interesting that you went to intelligence as sort of the value that you're looking for through all the maze of all the, you know, the unsavory language. But not everyone is looking for that. Different people are looking for different things in the language that they listen to and respond
right.
to.
Right. And I would be willing to bet that when Carolyn gets together with other people who do stand-up comedy, where there is a rhythm, you know, there's a sort of a set-up punchline, there's like a whole way of speaking, I bet that you have a higher comfort level there than you do in a lot of other situations.
Sometimes. I don't know. I mean, I do tend to gravitate towards people who are going to speak more eloquently. The thing I hate the most is when people speak in a sentence but end it with a question mark even though it's not a question, that thing where their voice goes up and they just sound mm-hmm. not confident. I like to sound confident even if I am confident that I have no idea what I'm saying because I find it really sells it and people will look past. They're like, I don't think she meant what she was saying, or I hope she didn't. But I think that the funny thing with people in comedy is that they a lot of times tend to be pulling, like when you're listening to things, you're pulling from that and kind of grabbing in what other people are saying to sort of almost imitate it or find some sort of you're looking at situations in a different way. So when you have a room full of people in comedy, it's like they're all just gauging each other and kind of it's sort of this weird like predators circling each other kind of thing going on sometimes. Where
you value it when people do it.
But right? I really, yeah, I'm not like making fun of Rand's incredible eloquence, but I love that. I am fascinated by that. And what's funny is if I was to go to write something, a lot of times more so I would be, but in speaking, it would just never occur to me.
We're going to do a break right here. We don't have to give up on this topic because I really do want to talk about, I think Irene or somebody sent us this piece about NPR talk. I think we have to weave that in there too. It's sort of the informalization of formal speech. We'll get to that when we come back. Actually, we have an email from Paul and Willimantic who's saying exactly what the panelists were saying while you were listening to the break. Don't confuse the big vocabulary with being articulate. That's absolutely right. We were just saying that. Using it for its own sake. Not so great. All right. Well, one of the other things that we looked at as we were getting ready for the show was a piece by Teddy Wayne in the New York Times talking about what he referred to as the NPR voice. He says, in addition to looser language, the speaker generously employs pauses and particularly at the end of sentences, emphatic inflection. This is a separate issue from upspeak, the tendency to conclude statements with question marks, which Carolyn was just talking about. A result is the suggestion of spontaneous speech and unadulterated emotion. The irony is that such presentations are highly rehearsed with each caesura, that's a nice word there, calculated and every syllable stressed in advance. And he goes on to cite Ira Glass as the guy who really is the most influential person in that way and the person who kind of introduced a new style. I would go on to say also that, you know, Carolyn, you were talking about Sarah Palin before, and in a way, I think she did that a little bit in politics, right? Her manner of speaking. Oh, I just did it right.
Yeah, I did it right.
She did that in politics. Her manner of speaking included a lot of you knows and things like that. Things that a formal speaker, someone running for vice president, they're not supposed to pepper their speech with that, but it was effective up to a point, was effective in suggesting, well, she's this kind of unscripted, informal person. And that's what we value now. I mean, Irene, one of the points of this article was that we have very, very seamlessly and quietly, silently gone from this very formalized manner of speaking, the way that Dan Rather used to speak, or the way that Walter Cronkite used to speak, you know, in these kind of formal situations, to an environment that really prizes this almost studied informality.
Yeah, I don't know how I don't know if I agreed with the writer that it was as studied as he thought. I mean, you think Ira Glass sits there and practices? Okay, how am I going to say it? Just with the
I'll almost guarantee you that Ira Glass retakes anything he does 25 times until it sounds exactly right. Just knowing a little bit about how their program's done.
Okay,
yeah.
All right. So, I guess I think Charlie Sheen is authentic. I think Ira Glass is authentic. I'm wrong because it's
I
all
think
studied.
The interesting thing is this unscripted. How the whole. Now, they want speakers. We tend to like speakers who are kind of more authentic or that we're perceiving to be real. But and it's the same thing with television. Like now we like reality TV and we like these series that are somewhat unscripted where it's that there's like a guideline and the actors are just improvising. And you know, as a performer, that's a lot of fun. But the behind the scenes with that reality and those unscripted series is really a lot more scripted than you think. But I do think that it's interesting that now as a culture, we are really much more into this, even if it is just kind of this seeming sense of everything being an improv and unscripted.
Give me Edward R. Murrow. You know, I don't know. I like the other kind.
Well, but I think it's worth saying, what is the most prized? What is the most valued talent right now? And I think the most valued talent was the ability to kind of nail it that way, in that pretty formal way that suggested that you were able to do that. And now I think what is I think the values have shifted. I mean, it's not a complete shift, but that you get rewarded now for being able to achieve that casual sound when you speak.
Can we ask you that, Colin? I mean, are you conscious about how you speak in that respect?
Well, we're going to talk if we have time in this. We're also going to talk about the fact that one of the things that happened has happened is a lot of people are broadcasting who didn't used to be broadcasters, particularly with the rise of the podcast. And so I entered into this world, into that world at exactly that point. I think I came into radio having no radio skills whatsoever and no radio training whatsoever. And if you notice the way that John Dankosky talks and the way that I talk, I'm not as polished as John. I hope people will forgive me for that, although I get a lot of emails suggesting that they don't. But, Rand, what were you going to say?
Well, you just stole some of my thunder, since the comparison of you and Mr. Dankosky was something I was going to bring up. A Yiddish scholar sometime last century said that a standard language is nothing but a dialect with an army and a navy. The notion being that it takes a sort of belief in imperial force to enforce one standardized way of speaking and derogate all others as inferior. The web and the social media that have spun off of it are a great democratizing force in communications. And so the empire, the army and navy have sort of been sent away. This is the framework that I'm seeing this in, and voices that were formerly marginalized that didn't speak the standard language, including our host here, are now flourishing. And you know, for years, it's interesting that NPR would be sort of the subject of this particular inquiry for years. And I still listen to on the weekends the reruns of Car Talk, and there always came that very satisfying moment at the end when they would say, "Although Carl Castle has nightmares about it, this is NPR." The joke of that was that guys who would sound like that would ever be on public radio. And, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, that was a great joke. And I remember when Colin first started here, you know, I thought, well, how's that going to go? Because McEnroe doesn't really sound like an NPR guy. John Dankosky has the NPR voice. And Colin, well, you know, he's much more eccentric verbally. Sometimes it seems like he mumbles a little bit. He moves laterally. He jumps quickly. It's not that sonorous official speaker. And so what, you know, we're talking about here and what that article interestingly did is said that this has become such this a mark of authenticity that people are now practicing at, say, he accused Michelle Obama of practicing a certain kind of stutter so that she would sound more sort of authentically earnest.
Yeah, like she was coming to these things. I want to save time for emojis, but I mean, one proof of this, Carolyn, would be in what previous world would Marc Maron have an incredibly successful interview show? You know, a guy whose diction and voice and, I mean, everything about his presentation is absolutely wrong for any kind of interview show. But, I mean, he's, you know, WTF is just this incredibly popular thing. So, and he's an example also of someone who managed to sound very genuine. Mm-hmm. He can't ask a question without running through all of the, you know, I'm going to ask you this question. You're taller. I'm short. Do you think I'm short? I think I'm short, too. Takes him 20 minutes of this to just get one question out. Anyway, we have to quickly shift gears and talk about the fact that Oxford Dictionaries has picked an emoji as a word of the year. And Wolfie, I think we can have Siri tell them what that emoji is.
Face with tears of joy.
Face with tears of joy. Thank you, Sarah Flaherty, our intern, who did that for me today. So, so Carolyn, well, actually, I'm going to start maybe with Irene, since she's the English teacher. is this another sign? Are we going to go declinist on this? Is this another sign that our civilization is in decay?
I don't know. I mean, somewhere in the article it said they were modern hieroglyphics, so it is kind of interesting to think, all right, language started with a kind of hieroglyphics, now it's devolving back into it. But I think they're fun. So the fact that it's the word of the year, I find, I can't help. My English teacher self can't help feel, you know, raise an eyebrow to that, but on the other hand, I think it's true.
If you cannot afford a declinist, we will appoint one for you. Here, I have one.
Well,
here's your court-appointed declinist.
Know, of course, the miniaturization of all forms of communication is a great bugbear of mine. I was yesterday in an idle moment looking through a magazine, Men's Health, that you have written for over the years, and when I look through these magazines, I think, well, could I ever write something for such a magazine? And since I looked for blocks of text that were longer than an inch. And didn't find any. And so I thought, well, I could never write anything for this magazine because I don't just scatter little bits of text around. So what I found amusing, in addition to the notion that an emoji would be word of the year, the article says, quote someone saying, the rise of text-centric communication apps such as blah, 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 have made emojis a necessary solution for expressing emotion as clearly as possible. That's a limitation the written text has never been able to overcome. The idea that written text has never been able to express emotion clearly. If only Nabokov, the Brontes, Dickens, or whoever wrote the Song of Songs could have known that. He would have written, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your emoji, that is love, is better than wine. I mean,
All right. I'd like to go over to Jim Webb right now. No, it's actually Carolyn Payne.
No,
he mentioned you, so you can talk.
Okay. All right. So I think they meant that, like, text messaging hasn't been able to.
Because
they're, like, text.
I didn't say that.
I understand. But I took it as to mean that when you send a text, it's really hard sometimes to make sure that you're communicating correctly through that text message. So even though I don't have an iPhone, so I can't express myself in emojis. And this has been really upsetting because all I want to do is send a smiling pile of poo to when someone says, how are you doing today or what are you doing? I just want to answer with poop.
Okay.
And
yeah,
I can't.
I see that. So the point is, if we're not going to really use language, why use words?
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
but
okay.
No. What I'm saying is when you send a text, there's a lot
don't
of times.
Don't fall into his traps, Carolyn.
I'm not. I will not. there are times where you're not sure how to take that text. But if you add like a little smiley face
or
at
the pile
end,
of poop, that's pretty unequivocal.
Right. Yeah. And it shows that it's not, because a text can come across sometimes as sort of curt and not as, you know, and you're trying to express like, no, I'm not. When you're like, where are you? And you say like smiley face, it's not, I'm not mad that you're late. I'm just genuinely wondering where you are. But whereas it's where are you and angry face, like then you know the person knows like, oh, I'm running really late and this person is upset. So I feel like I do use those to kind of express the tone of my voice, which you can't get through a text
message. Well, let me just see if I can not so much push back against Rand, but introduce Rand to a different way of thinking about this. So first of all, one of the things that I've discovered this week is that you can just, with a slight bit of tinkering to your iPhone, you can have Siri read the emojis out loud. And I discovered this by – I should do a shout-out to The Gist on Mike Pesca's The Gist. This is where I heard this. So so thanks to Mike Pesca, I know how to do this. And so I had Sarah Flaherty, our intern, just have Siri read a series of emoji.
Customer service person with light skin tone. Smiling pile of poo. Eggplant. Turtle.
So it occurred to me, Rand – that, you know, that the modernists, that James Joyce would have really loved emojis, you know, that he might have really liked to play around with emojis. And, I mean, I can't speak for the other modernists, but, you know, Pound said, make everything new. You know, that probably there were some people doing great literature, not, you know, almost simultaneously with Nabokov, who would have loved this and would have messed around with it in interesting ways.
I think that's true, but there would have been ways to mess around with it without the emoji becoming actually the fundamental unit of your literary construction. What's most interesting to me about that article and is the speculation that over time, emojis could become a kind of language, a pictograph-based language that maybe over the next 1,000 years, you know, what will emerge will be a Chinese-like pictographic language using emojis. I like that idea, but, you know, that idea is also one that takes this very simple unit and then builds ultimately great edifices of complex language. And by the time that happens 1,000 years from now, you know, my ghost will be giving the thumbs up.
Right. That's in the long list of things that you'll be happy that you're dead for. All right. So we have to stop here, so we'll have time for endorsements. We'll do that. We'll come back.
A creepy song. Pages, CDs, floppies. Thank God we now have these red flags and these green flags. An unholy high five. A dragon close up with a mustache. All sorts of books and all these arrows are really, really important.
Today's show was produced by Colin McEnroe, Lydia Brown, and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Our interns are Amanda Gallagher and Sarah Flaherty. The part of Bill Curry was played by Emilio Estevez. For show pages, articles, and instructions on how to say here and now in emojis, visit our website WNPR.org/Colin. On Monday's show, Lawrence Lessig and Colin debate whether Connecticut clean election laws really work. And now, back to Colin.
Yes, Lawrence Lessig, a legal scholar and erstwhile presidential candidate, often cites Connecticut as this place to really kind of fix its election process, which I feel he says because he doesn't know how bad things have gotten here. So he and I will talk about
his
that.
His campaign must be really over.
It is. He's done.
Because he's here.
Yeah, exactly. He's actually withdrawn. Anyway, it's time to do endorsements. Before we do endorsements, let me mention also that tonight, Kyone Wolf will be hosting her storytelling event, The Mouth. Tonight, 7:30, Mark Twain House and Museum. Get there early. It sells out. This one is going to be animal stories. And admission is just $5, which is one of the reasons it sells out. Also, it's really a lot of fun. Storytelling is taking off. All right. So time to endorse. Maybe Irene and I can quickly endorse together The Garden of Emoji Delights, which is up at Real Artways. Did you want to try to quickly describe it?
If you know the Hieronymus Bosch painting called The Garden of Earthly Delights, think of that giant-sized with emoji delights in there instead.
Yes, it's by Carla Gannis is the creator of – it's called what's called a digital sea print. I don't really know exactly what that is, but she's used digital technology somehow to do this. And
that's when you have a print, but then you add on digitally these details that give it texture on the surface of it.
All right. So Real Art Ways, go see it. I think it's there till January. All right. So we'll do regular endorsements. We'll start with Rand.
I'm a big fan of the Indian restaurant Utsav in Ellington, and one of the co-founders of that restaurant opened a few years ago an Indian restaurant called Indigo. It's in Manchester, right on the East Hartford line. It's sort of in an innocuous-looking strip mall. You would never see it. On Silver Lane, I think it is. Indigo Indian Bistro. I love the place. It's terrific. The people are really friendly there, and it's great food. Second thing, my wife, daughter, and I all love Broadway musicals, and occasionally we wander into the community theater scene here. So this weekend we are going. The West Hartford Community Theater is doing Carousel. There still are tickets available. It's at Hall High School this weekend, so you can go onto the West Hartford Community Theater website and get tickets to Carousel.
All right. Irene, what have you got for us? By the way, Wolfie likes that restaurant too. What have you got for us?
I have. Well, every Friday I have breakfast with a friend of mine, and I first of all would recommend that, like just having a standing date with people that you want to talk to, because otherwise you'll never see them. But anyway, we always walk into West Hartford, and this lately a couple of times we walked to this place called Sam's Gyro, which you would never think of as a place to go for breakfast, but they have breakfast, and the guy makes these beautiful omelets with spinach, and he has this beautiful presentation, and it's fun place to go for breakfast, and you can sit outside even now.
Is that on South Main Street?
South Main Street. Yeah, surprisingly good.
They've also tried to do jazz at night there.
It looks
like some kind of Viggo Mortensen movies to break out there.
I know. I want to go for that too. Sam's Gyro.
And the gyro's good.
And quickly, there's this book of essays that I'm reading called Grammar Lessons, Translating a Life in Spain by this woman named Michelle Morano, who talks about moving to Spain, learning to speak the language, and her love life and all kinds of things. It's just a lovely book of essays that I recommend.
All right, Carolyn.
All right. I am actually embarrassed that I'm endorsing this, but I stumbled upon it, and it's really quite good. Scream Queens, it's on Fox. It's Jamie Lee Curtis is just phenomenal in it. When I first heard that she was in it, I was like, what is she?
What is the concept?
It's a sorority house at a college, and they're slowly getting killed off one by one, and there's a whole backstory. So it's kind of, you know, it's your classic slasher. She plays the dean of students, and she is phenomenal. And I'm sure, like, you've seen, like, bits and pieces playing in different media. Episode a couple weeks ago, she recreated her character is in the shower and gets attacked. So it's, you know, it recreates the scene from Psycho, but there's obviously a twist to it. It's actually so well written it's a show that knows that it's not, you know, it's not like a Breaking Bad. It's not going to be this amazingly well written show, but it is so poorly written to be well written, if that makes sense. And it really is just great. And it's a really fun way to just sit and pass a couple hours. So you can catch up on it. And it has like 4 more episodes, I think, this year.
I actually do a Tumblr of things that Carolyn has admitted to on this show, and really being embarrassed about that doesn't really make any sense given some of the other things that you've talked about, really.
True.
Is that it for you?
That's it for me today.
Okay, so I've got a few today. So first of all, I really recommend the movie The Siege. It was done by the director Edward Zwick. It was done way before 9/11. It stars Denzel Washington, Tony Shalhoub, Bruce Willis, and Annette Bening. It's about a terrorist attack in New York, and it's so predictive. It's so prescient about things, and it really anticipates, for example, something that's being talked about a lot right now: internment. Bruce Willis is this militaristic, colonel or general who does intern Muslims right there in New York City. It's I think a terrific movie. But then I'm also a big believer, as people who listen to the show might know, in reading things that attack things that you like. So the scholar Mustafa Bayoumi, who was on yesterday, has a new book called This Muslim American Life. It's a book. One of the things, the last section of it is about Muslims and culture. And he rips this movie to shreds in a way that I didn't find completely persuasive, but was really, really interesting. So watch The Siege if you've never seen it. You will be amazed that somebody made this movie before 9/11. And then if you feel like having your suppositions pulled apart, you can track down Mustafa's work. In the world of a couple of podcast things, particularly if you've seen by now Spectre, listen to the first 42 minutes or so of Daniel Craig's interview on the Nerdist podcast. The Nerdist podcast is a very weird thing because Chris Hardwick is not a good interviewer, but he and his confederates are so good at relaxing people that they talk in a way that they don't typically talk. And Daniel Craig reveals himself to, first of all, be a very funny person, like a very funny person, and a pretty normal person considering all the things, all the excuses he would have not to be normal. So, but after about 40 minutes, these interviews go on way too long, and you can actually tell there's like a moment where you think, oh, now they're just asking. They have no idea what to ask, but this will just keep going. Also, now this is not for everybody. This is only for a small group of you. You have to have. This is much worse than anything Carolyn has just endorsed. The Rosenthal and Jeselnik Vanity Project. This is a podcast that features the comedian Anthony Jeselnik, who is a notoriously, I think you would agree, tasteless comedian who has this persona, this arrogant strutting persona. And he and his best friend, Greg Rosenthal, now do a podcast about football on the NFL Network. And they're constantly just talking about how they're about to be canceled, which I think is probably true. All right. I've got lots of other things that I could endorse, but I'll stop there now. But like, if you have refined sensibilities at all, don't listen to that. But if you do, go back a few episodes because you need to. They need to set up their storyline a little bit. Thanks to Rand, Carolyn, and Irene.
Top hat, lipstick, Virgo sign, left arrow.
Kyone, cut it out. It's not funny.
Japanese flag flashlight.
I'm serious. You think you're being cute, but...
Trumpet trophy soccer ball.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty funny.
I have no idea what I just said.